Yes, so thank you very much indeed for inviting me. Vajra Devi cajoled me into coming. I tried to get out of it, but she caught me and kept me. I was asked some time ago what my theme was going to be, so I inquired what subjects were suggested, and it was suggested it could be either right view or Kalyanamitrata. So I said, oh, well, do them both. And so those have been, you've been brought here to hear about right livelihood, right view and Kalyanamitrata, and I'm sure those topics will arise. Because you can hardly do anything on Dhamma without them arising. But what I'm going to do is to talk to you about things I've been talking to Bhante about, and especially things that I'm at the moment writing about. I haven't got a very clear form for it because I'm in the middle of writing, and it's quite difficult to get my thoughts into a nice, neat, orderly pattern in advance. But I'm very confident that something will emerge, and that it will be of interest and usefulness, I think, to everybody. So I'm not quite clear how this is going to go. What I'm aiming to do tonight is to introduce the topic broadly, and then tomorrow to have a number of sessions in which I will go a bit further, and then open up for questions and discussion. I may get you to do some things. You know, you have to have some sort of exercise-y type things. So, you know, change your underwear. But, yes, it won't be that kind. It won't be that sort of exercise. But, yes, I in a way, I want some help from you for the things that I'm writing at the moment. I want to explore a bit with other order members some of the things I'm writing about. So, yes, I've been having these conversations with Bhante. I've had, I think, four or five sessions of four or five discussions with him, sometimes twice a day when he's been fit and well enough. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about that and what motivated me to do it, because I've already heard strange rumours echoing around about that. Not, of course, from Cambridge. But I was concerned about quite a number of things that I thought Bhante has given inconsistent messages about, because his own thinking has evolved over 50 years. So I was noticing that Bhante was being quoted against Bhante. I thought it was worth getting a few issues sorted out while we've still got him, and while he's still so active mentally. I also wanted to clear up a few issues that I had personally in relation to him, in relation to the order, in relation to the movement. So I took the opportunity with others to explore matters with him. We, of course, explored the nature of the order and his understanding of it. This was something that was very, very important to me, as I'm sure some people are well aware. I'd become very concerned that so many diverse interpretations of the order had arisen that in a generation or so, it was very unlikely that we'd be able to maintain the degree of unity that I think is useful. So we got Bhante to address that issue. He defined the order as the community of his disciples. And I know that has been problematic for some people. I don't think it's, if you really know what he means, that difficult or contentious, unless you've really come to the conclusion that Bhante is not your teacher, is not a valid redactor of the Dhamma. if you've really come to that conclusion, then you've got a problem. But for most people, you know, with all our little nuances of relationship to Bhante, I think what he said covers you, if you see what I mean. That the order comes out of Bhante's understanding. The ordination that we have comes out of his initiative, his initiation. And the order rests upon him in that sense. I don't think it means that we need to agree with him on every particular. It doesn't mean that we have to think that he's all perfect and all knowing and so forth. He isn't. He's made no pretense to be. So, yes, that was something that was very, very important to me. I felt it was something that was slipping away in the confusion of the times. You may not agree with me, but that was the conclusion I came to. In the course of that discussion, it came obvious that we needed to talk more about Bhante's own view of his own history, especially in certain respects. And I must say, I came to understand Bhante's own character and point of view a lot better through those discussions. He was very, very open with us. Very willing to go into things that clearly cost him quite a lot of overcoming a reticence of character. He said to me after the discussions on the conversations about his history that you probably don't realise what this has cost me. It goes completely against the grain of my character and even of my principles, he said. He doesn't think that people should necessarily talk about everything about themselves. But he did it because he believed that it was needed. He believed that it would perhaps clarify things. And it's like I did myself feel very, very much closer to him and a very much better understanding of how he saw things. Anyway, I got an impression of Bhante as a much simpler man in a way than I'd previously thought, and a more innocent man, and I realised that he sees things in his own particular way, which is quite different from the way many other people see things around him. I was very struck by what he said about empathy. It's something that's always bewildered me that. People can often come away from seeing Bhante very, very delighted and feeling that Bhante's affirmed utterly their complete wrong views, in my humble opinion. Then later he'll explain how, you know, these particular views are not very helpful or whatever. So you think, well, why didn't you say? But he's empathising. He's getting into communication. And the critical faculty follows on later. He's a man. He's a human being, and he's living in a complex situation, with relating to a huge number of people of a very great variety, coming from a pre-war Britain, as it were, and then a post-independence India, into a flower power Britain, and his view of things is very strongly affected by his own experience. So, yes, I came to have a much, much deeper sympathy with him and appreciation of him. Yeah, in those conversations, I came to have a much closer, deeper personal appreciation of Bhante, and appreciation of the position that he's in. The conversations about view were ones I wanted to have because I felt that Bhante had left quite a number of hostages to fortune in his own writings and work. What was particularly concerning me were the absolutist language that runs through especially his earlier writing. The transcendental with flashing lights around it, the absolute, the non-dual, and so on and so forth. I've never had that much personal difficulty with that. I've always felt I've understood what he was getting at. But I've had to deal over and over again with people's misunderstandings of that. And when we've tried to tackle especially the much-vexed question of the unconditioned, Bhante's got very, very clever sophisticated answers to that, how you can have an unconditioned which is conditioned, etc. I still felt that the conundrum remains. So it's principally that that I wanted to get clear. And I had, I must say, the best communication I've ever had with Bhante. I went, well, in a sense, equal communication. I mean, equal in the sense that we were on equal footing, even though his understanding is so much greater than mine. And we created something between us, which is very, very satisfying. And especially what he had to say about the niyamas. And the niyamas as... as really explicating in fuller and richer terms how Pratityasamuppada is a middle way between eternalism and nihilism. Because it's very easy to show that Pratityasamuppada dismisses eternalism. It's not so easy to show how it dismisses nihilism, especially as that's the default setting of most of us coming into the movement from the West. So I think the richer explication that he gave of the niyamas, especially discussing the Dharma niyama as the sum of those processes that carry one to enlightenment, which are in a sense independent of individual volition, really shows how eternalism too is not the case. So some people have said, are we all to believe in niyamas now? Are we all to talk about niyamas now? Well, that's not really the point. I'm sure you understand that. The right view is Pratityasamuppada. But the niyamas, the explication of the niyamas, makes it far clearer than I think any other explanation that can be given how the niyamas are the middle way or express the middle way between eternalism and nihilism and how the Dhamma life unfolds. And they point to what is really significant for us, which is karma and dharma. What is important for Buddhists is in Pratityasamuppada is karma and dharma. That's what emerges from it. Our Dhamma life is lived in conformity with the principles of karma and dharma. We need to act skillfully so that our minds emerge in more and more subtle and sensitive and pliable ways. I think it's something I'd not really fully appreciated about karma until quite recently, just the extent to which the business end of karma is what it does to you immediately. Karma gets so often talked in the tradition in terms of what happens from outside. You know, how external events can be the outcome of a skillful or unskillful activity. Well, I certainly think that we shouldn't dismiss that realm of karmic conditionality. The mind does affect the other niyamas directly and indirectly. And effects may come back to us through the other niyamas in not very obvious ways. But the most important thing about karma is that our actions are shaping our minds. Our minds form our experience. The way in which we take in information, the way in which the structure of our minds is emerges, is karmically determined. So if you're not able to get into jhana, brothers and sisters, there's a good reason for it. you have not created the karmic basis for it. Your mind is too coarse, too scattered, too harsh to have an affinity with it. This is, the Buddha makes this quite clear, for instance, the Arya Paryasana Sutta, that happiness, as in the sense of pamoja and so forth, sukha, arises in dependence on skillful action. And concentration, samadhi, arises in dependence on happiness. So an uplifted, happy, contented, innocent mind is the basis for refined experiences of dhyana. It's a bit hard for us because we live in a very complex society in which our minds are, in a sense, all the time being blunted, so that it's much harder for us to get into those more refined mental states. But this is the traditional teaching. It's an inescapable. This is what Bhante's saying, that our actions now form our way of experiencing. Not just our experience in the sense of the things that happen to us, but the machinery, the faculties through which we experience. So we're all the time recreating ourselves so that we explore the world in new ways, in richer ways. Everybody's got experience of this in a good meditation. You go in one state, you do the metta bhavana, and you come out of it seeing the world differently. I think the most powerful experience that we have of this kind, and many of us have of this kind, is in the field of aesthetics. I'm going to talk much more about this tomorrow because this is the subject of my last set of conversations which I'm now writing up. And I've had so many experiences in my life of, for instance, going to an art gallery and going in a bit of a ho-hum mood. One needs to do a bit of art every now and again. And you wander around the gallery and you're not really engaging. Of course, what you need to do then is go and have a cup of tea. And you come out from your cup of tea and you go into the gallery and your eye is suddenly caught. Something catches your attention. You're arrested. And the painting sort of sucks you into itself. And your eyes open to the picture. I think I've quoted it quite recently, but I remember going to see the Vermeers in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. And I was astonished coming out. Everything was Vermeer. Everything was so simple and dignified and pure poised with a sort of luminous depth to it. My eyes had changed through being taken into Vermeer's world. And you're going, Akash Ashura is here, we'll do the Dutch. Seeing Rembrandt, and then suddenly you see faces and you see that the character written in the face and the humanity shining in the face, or not shining in the face, etched into the face. So that's probably our commonest experience of being altered, our minds being altered, almost dramatically altered. A retreat, you go on a retreat, you do some effort on the retreat, at the end of the retreat you feel so different. And you watch it leach away as you get into the old world, as it were. So it's the effort that you make, the effort that you make to engage with the work of art, the effort that you make to engage with meditation, the effort you make to engage with the subject of the retreat, all the practices of the retreat, with the people on the retreat, all changes you. You're a different person. And I used to get this experience a lot when I was early involving with the movement. I'd forget what it was like. I'd go on retreat, and I hadn't been for some time, and I think, oh yes, this experience is one I've had before. I've forgotten it. It's so different. You're shaping yourself in such a different way. So Yes, so in these conversations, this sort of notion of karma as a transformation of one's own mind and what we really need to be engaged with. That's all Dhamma life consists in. Work at karma. Work at putting out skillful actions, speeches, mental states. And everything will follow from that. Don't worry about the end result. The Buddha says this, doesn't he? That look after the karma, the results will come. Plant the seed, the harvest will come. So I think we should not be too concerned about the end results, about realization or whatever. It will come if you put in the karmic effort. So this was the first thing I got from these discussions, this stress on karma as the business end of Pratityasamuppada. But more mysteriously and more deeply, engagingly, the theme of the Dharma Niyama emerged much more strongly. I think we need to be very careful in the language we use about Dharma Niyama. And I've already heard usages abroad that I'm afraid make me cringe. I think I'd rather have the absolute than the Dharma Niyama. The Dharma Niyama becomes a thing. It's actually a filing cabinet, a drawer in a five-tiered filing cabinet, which contains a number of conditioned relationships of a certain kind and quality, if you see what I mean. There is no such thing as the Dharma Niyama. There are conditioned processes that can be categorized under the heading of Dharma Niyama. Something very, very important to get hold of. And I've been trying to watch my language and keep on saying Dharma Niyama processes and try to avoid substantializing it. The Dharma Niyama. Don't say it. It just plays back into the old eternalist model and actually misses the point. So the Dharma Niyama processes are, Bhante says, part of the way things are. The universe is constructed in such a way that under certain conditions, heavier bodies attract lighter bodies. Under certain conditions, and I won't even attempt any more science, my science is so cod that it's not worth it. Stimulus response will work in certain ways. All of that is just built into the way things are. There are certain patterns that are replicated again and again in reality. Reality is niyamata, it's ordered. Niyama comes from a root meaning to limit. So it means limit in the sense of necessity, you could say. There's a necessity built into things. Things will happen in certain ways. But it's not a reductive legalization of the universe. It's saying that those patterns can happen in much more mysterious ways that completely transcend the physical dimension. That once they come into play, lead on to Buddhahood itself, and who knows, beyond. Buddhahood is simply the furthest that we can think, if we can even think that far. What happens after that is unthinkable to us, literally unthinkable. It's imaginable, but that's another question which we'll come on to tomorrow. So yes, the Dharma Niyama is a category of all those processes that move in an augmentative way beyond human willing. Once human volition has been seen through, once we've understood that there is no real I that actually makes decisions. I explored this quite a bit on my solitary retreat. I got a long solitary retreat I did in 2008. I got fascinated by the issue of making decisions. The principal one that I got fascinated was getting up in the morning. I'm not actually somebody who has a lot of difficulty with getting up in morning, unlike some friends of mine. But I became interested in how that decision got made to get up. And and so there was a period during my solitary retreat, fairly early on, where I didn't get up. And I just lie there, sort of trying to work out how to make the decision. Because there was no external impulsion upon me, and there sort of didn't seem to be a lot of internal impulsion, apart from the fact it got a bit uncomfortable. So I'd sort of suspend the decision. And at a certain point, I'd find that I was up. Usually I was up in the toilet, and physiological issues had taken over and taken me there. But I found it really interesting. I then sort of think back, when did I actually decide? And I couldn't really see where I decided. And I sort of had quite a strong impression that the idea of myself deciding was pretty, what can I say, sort of, it's useful, but doesn't go very deep. It's just a useful way of labelling something that happens that's far more than me in a conscious sense. So, I hope this can connect, beginning to ramble, but I'll do a lot of this over the next few days, but it'll be good. So the Dharma Niyama takes over when you recognise that the idea of I is simply an operational concept. It's just an evolutionary development that has been useful for survival purposes, but that has no reference to anything ultimately real. It belongs to nothing that is substantial. So when you see through that, you are able to allow processes to unfold, as it were, within you, that are not really you. They're not anybody else either, but they're not really you. We're familiar with these processes, for instance, in the account of the positive nidanas. They're the processes that we see unfolding from knowledge and vision of things as they really are to nibbida. Is that right? Disgust.
Dispassion?
That's viraga. I can't remember which way around they go. But, the next in the positive chain. I think it is nibbida and then viraga, yes, and then vimoksha. So these are the Dhamma Niyama processes. That you are in a state of recognition of the real nature of things, you see directly that there is no fixed self. You see directly that there cannot be, it's not that you just see that there isn't, you see that there cannot be anything permanent. And you see that directly that there cannot be within a conditioned phenomenon anything that can give you real deep satisfaction. It can give you pleasure, but it cannot give you abiding satisfaction. So you see that absolutely plain, directly. And that, of its own momentum, gives rise to another process. You don't have to decide to have it. You don't have to think about it. It just happens.
Something has gone wrong. Can you just check if it's actually plugged and turned on? Let's turn on the plug. Sorry.
Okay. Technology. Yes, so you become aware directly of the way things are, and that of its own momentum gives rise to a feeling of, it's nibbida, which is usually translated as something like disgust or withdrawal. It's difficult to find an appropriate translation, because disgust is too, as it were, psychological a term. But it's just a feeling of don't want, not interested. I remember a wonderful experience walking around IKEA with Sangadeva, and I had to do some shopping, and so I was going around buying what I had to buy, and Sangadeva was there just to help me and drive it home with me, as it were. And he walked round, and I realised that he was grinning. So I sort of turned to him, and he said, "You know, I'm really enjoying this." And so I thought, oh God, you know, he's getting the IKEA craving. So I said, "But, you know, why are you enjoying it?" He said, "I've realised there's nothing here I want." And he was enjoying, you know, on one level or another, a sense of nibbida. Don't want. Not for me. Not mine. Viraga, of course, is a more, a deeper dimension of that. And you can see what I mean. It sort of unfolds of its own natural momentum. You don't have to think, okay, I've got nibbida, now I have to create viraga. As you do when you have shraddha, you need to work to create whatever comes next. Pamoja, yeah, etc. You have to do something karmically to create it. But once the dharma niyama processes begin to unfurl, you can't stop them. You can accelerate them. Your liberty is to cooperate with them so that they unfold more quickly. So traditionally, it's said that once yata bhuta jnana darshana has arisen, the seven lifetimes till arahatva. But what Bhante said is that that's if you just, lie on the beach and wait for it. He didn't actually say that, but lie on the spiritual beach and wait for it. Sounds tempting, doesn't it? But you can keep working. And the Buddha keeps on exhorting people, not to rest even with stream entry. You still have something to learn. You're still a trainee, interestingly enough, until arahatva comes. You're still a shiksha, sekha. So once the dharma niyama unfolds, something begins to work, as it were, inside you that is independent of your own volition. And of course, Bhante ties that up with bodhicitta, because it's not that you, in transcending your egoistic volition, it's not that you then become volition free. It's not that you then don't want to do anything. The motivation that takes over is compassion. The motivation that takes over is a desire to share your experience with others. Desire is almost the wrong word. I remember reading Bhante when he was first his eyesight first deteriorated. He asked me to read to him Porphyry's life of Plotinus, and in that life, Porphyry dwells upon what Plotinus says about pity, which is often translated as compassion. And Plotinus said that he had no pity, that pity was completely alien to him. That it's nothing to do with the Platonic life, if you like. But then Porphyry goes on to comment upon Plotinus' extraordinary kindness and his extraordinary responsiveness to particularly the needs of his disciples, and the way in which, for instance, one of his disciples died and Plotinus simply took his family into his own family. And he wasn't a wealthy man. He took his family into his own family, educated the children, and so on, and how in many, many ways he exhibited absolutely remarkable kindness and compassion. And Bhante's comment was that, yes, we too often think of compassion sentimentally. We think of it as a sort of an emotion. And he said it's not an emotion at all. It's simply a response. You see a need, and you respond without a second thought. It just happens. And this is what bodhicitta is. Bodhicitta is this response independent of any egoistic volition that simply deals with the needs in the world around you, wherever you can and wherever it's appropriate to do so, without any intervention of sentimentality, of self-consciousness, of pity, of even, you could say, emotion. These processes, these mysterious processes, begin to unfold once one's achieved a karmic preparedness. You have to work with the idea of I, with I as agent, to build an emerging mind that can drop that idea and can give itself up to forces that are independent of that egoistic agency. So our spiritual life is to be lived in independence upon those two forces, the forces that come under the heading of karma, the forces that come under the heading of dharma. We need to be acting skillfully all the time to build a new mind for ourselves, and we need to be learning to open ourselves up to see through the idea of self. This is, of course, what Vipassana practice is about. This is what six element practice is about. It's about recognizing that it is not me, it is not I, it is not myself. These are simply, this is what mindfulness is, in truly speaking. It's seeing the processes that you pay attention to as not mine. They're not anybody else's. You're not alienated from them. You accept them fully, you feel them fully, but without attachment, without identification. We're training ourselves to let go, of self. And we're especially training ourselves to open up to something that is far more than I. Bhante thinks that this element is extremely important. He thinks that it's too easy to think of Dharma life in almost mechanical terms, to reduce it too much. And I'm going to have a lot to say about this tomorrow. I'm really building you up for tomorrow. But there must be some sense of a mysterious dimension beyond what is knowable that you are opening up yourself up to and learning to allow to unfold within you, so that when you have the karmic basis for it, you can let go decisively of self-clinging and allow those processes to work fully and dynamically within you. So what my conversations with him began to center around was really two things. How do we talk about that dimension that's beyond our reach? And how do we talk about the dynamic that carries one to it, if you see what I mean? Because you can view you can view things in terms of something that you're working towards, and you can view them in terms of something that is working itself out through you, in you. And I think both perspectives are necessary. I think if you don't think of something that you're working towards, you can only think of the goal in humanistic terms. You can only think of it in very personal terms. I remember once going to a lecture on humanism, and what struck me most was the aesthetic response I had to it. I felt claustrophobic. I felt that I was being starved of oxygen. I was being put in too narrow a cabin. I was being cribbed in. Because the perspective was just this life, humanity, which is a pretty miserable thing when you look at it closely. And frankly, I couldn't live with that. I think I just want to die. It's not worth it. There's quite a lot of pleasure in things, but you have to pay so hard for it. So there must be some sense of something that's beyond comprehension that you are giving yourself to and that you're living your life for. Without that dimension, we're mere good people. We're Nietzsche's positive nihilists. Nietzsche was afraid that Western history would end with what he called positive nihilism. He thought it would end with Buddhism, because he thought of Buddhism as a sort of positive nihilism. You know, in other words, we're kind to each other until the lights go out, until the end of things. So he was afraid that this was the direction of Western culture. And I think, as usual, Nietzsche was unusually prescient, gloomy but prescient. And I think a lot of us actually are positive nihilists. Nice people, nice, good, decent people. We recycle our glass and we're reasonably kind. And but we're not giving ourselves to a transcendent ideal, what Bhante dares to call a transcendental object. We'll come back to transcendental objects tomorrow. Cue for a song. So, yes, we need to, Bhante very strongly considers we need a transcendental object. But we also need a sense of an active force. You know, in Christianity, it's the great problem of immanence and transcendence. Because if God is transcendent, how can you ever know him? Because if he completely transcends his creation, then creation must be separate from him. He can't be affected by it. If, on the other hand, God is imminent in creation, he made a damn bad job of it. And all the problems of theodicy arise, the problem of evil, and so on. So, but I think that this is that what Christianity in its own way is groping at is these two problems of a goal that is beyond you, something that you are becoming that is much more than you, beyond even your understanding, and a something that is working within you that in a way is beyond your comprehension. And if one doesn't have some sense of these two mysteries, maybe they're the same mystery actually, but the same mystery viewed from different perspectives, it's very hard really to live a Buddhist life. Right view is about clarifying what things aren't, if you see what I mean. It's about things not being eternal. There is nothing that is fixed and unchanging. On the other hand, it's about things not being ultimately dead, closed, nothing. So what right view is first of all concerned it with is clarifying what things are not and thereby what they are. It defines the limits of the thinkable. It defines what we can justifiably think about and what we cannot think, what is beyond the reach of reason, atakavacharo. Very interesting, I came across recently a very famous sutta, the Great 40, wonderful sutta, in which the Buddha talks about two kinds of right view. There's the right view that's this side of attachment, you know this one, and the right view that's the other side of attachment. Beautiful phrases, I love that. And right view, this side of attachment, is recognizing, I haven't got it off pat, I won't even refer to my notes, but it's really basically recognizing karma. It's recognizing that there are actions, there are agents, there is an agent, you. There are actions that are effective. There are results of actions. So it's recognizing the mechanics of pratityasamuppada as they affect you. So right view, this side of attachment, is recognizing that there is a karmic kind of conditionality. That's why you need to understand things as they are. You need to understand them in that way so that you are fully convinced there's nothing fixed, there's nothing changed about you, about anything. That means you can change yourself completely. It means that the goal is not to be sought within a particular arrangement of reality. Furthermore, it's to be the goal is to be sought through the modification of your own mind by skillful action, and that you can live your life in such a way that you emerge as a more subtle, more positive, more refined being, and that goes on life after life. That process of refinement goes on life after life. So that's the business end of pratityasamuppada, this side of attachment. That's the business end of right view, this side of attachment. The other side of attachment, in a way, we can't really say. It's defined in terms of the seven bodhyangas, so that the seven factors of enlightenment. So it's defined in terms of these spiritual qualities that emerge in their fully fledged form, we're to understand. It's the spiritual qualities that emerge as a sequence, as a nidana chain, a dharma niyama sequence that leads on to full realization. So the right view is defined really in terms of karma niyama, this side of attachment, dharma niyama, the other side of attachment. I've just realized that, just speaking to you right now. That's the exciting thing about giving talks. That's what I came away from those discussions with Bhante, very strongly with the perspective that right view sort of clears away what you can know, what you need to know, but it leaves unspoken a vast and deeply appealing mystery. A mystery that one needs to have some connection with, some relationship with, if one is to be able to really activate spiritual life. And simply knowing about karma isn't enough. There needs to be some sense of aligning yourself with a force that's greater than you. There needs to be a sense of moving towards a goal that is far beyond your understanding. So I became interested in talking to Bhante more about that. What is in the mystery? How can we know the mystery? What can we know about the mystery? Because we can. We can know a lot about the mystery. But we cannot know it with our intellects. Our intellects can know right view. But they have to stop at that point, or they have to start to serve something else. Our intellects need to begin to be integrated into something that's bigger than our intellects. And at the end of that set of conversations, as those of you have read my paper on revering the Dhamma, Bhante says that what takes over when reason has flown as high as it can is imagination. And this has been an aspect of Bhante's teaching that has always deeply appealed to me, and that I have considered, in a sense, his greatest contribution, one of his greatest contributions to the development of the Dharma in the modern world. And oddly, a dimension of his teaching that he has said relatively little about. He's got scattered references to it here and there, but he said relatively little about it. And to me it's been extremely important because I found myself running out of inspiration from, please forgive me, Tibetan Buddhism. I know that there are those who are still very much inspired by it. I'm not against anybody who does find it inspiring. Please carry on. Great. But I found myself less and less sort of moved by the images and even the practices. I've done sadhana practice faithfully since my ordination until the last 10 years or so. But I found myself less and less able to connect with it, to relate to it. And I've been interested to observe that quite a lot of order members are in that condition. There are those who are not. And please, I will try to repeat this because one gets misunderstood. Okay, surprising, isn't it? One gets misunderstood. And I'm not trying to undermine anybody's genuine practice, anybody who's getting on really well with it. But many of us are not. And I don't think it's because we're bad and naughty and evil. I think it's because for some of us, or perhaps for all of us, there's a need to activate our own imaginations formed in the West, for those that are from the West, and of course the West covers a multitude of sins. Latin America is very different from Europe, and Eastern Europe is very different from Western Europe. Northern from southern and so forth. But still, there's a broad sort of Western consciousness, which I think that the imaginative world of the East does not always touch. It doesn't work for everybody. And if the Dhamma is really to live in the West, we need to activate, we need to touch the imagination of the West. And we've all got it. We cannot not have it. It's a very interesting and different issue that arises in India, which intrigues me in a very different way. One of the reasons why I've been so fascinated by this is because I work in India and in the West. I'm going to say much more about this tomorrow. The West has its own imaginative history, which is a very complex one. I'll give you a potted version of it tomorrow. India has its own history. It's a very, very rich imaginative world, the world of Hindu India. But Buddhists, especially Buddhists who've converted under the influence of Dr. Ambedkar, have to alienate themselves from that imaginative world because it's dangerous to them. Because to them it embodies a system that has oppressed them for thousands of years. And it's a system of superstition and exploitation. They have to get away from it. In the West, we're intrigued by this rich imaginative panoply. Since Jung, we're sort of able to see the value in archetypes expressed in images everywhere. But in India, they cannot afford to have that sort of view of their own cultural history. Their own Buddhist history is long past and is broken. So the consequence is that many Dalit Buddhists are rationalists of the most shallow and narrow kind. You find that for many, after Dr. Ambedkar, Bertrand Russell is the great hero, I ask you. Bertrand Russell. There you go. How do people in India connect with the imagination without putting themselves as hostages to the evil power, the malign for them power of Hinduism, which is by and large a system of superstition? It has its own higher dimensions and so forth, but by and large it's a system of superstition, which it's obviously got its good points, but what I mainly see of it is mere a magical system of beliefs to get material advantage. I often say that why is India so corrupt? It's because Indians mainly follow a corrupt religion. Because Indian religion is mainly about bribing the gods. isn't it? It's about keeping the gods in coconuts and incense and the right prayers. And then they're on your side. So of course you're going to think the policeman is he's just making the offerings to him. He doesn't like coconuts. They're no use to him. But, you know, 10 rupees in your driving license will let you go on your way. It's more than 10 rupees now. It's 100 rupees, I think. That's getting free medical treatment means, making an offering to the receptionist and the doctor. Free medical clinics, you have to make an offering. You have to give on incense and coconuts. So it's by and large a corrupt and corrupting religion. It has very little ethics in it, as it's generally practiced. There is an ethical dimension. There are ethical systems within it. So, they've had to cut themselves off from that huge, rich, imaginative world, extraordinarily rich, imaginative world. But they're the poorer for it in some ways. They're the better for it in many ways, but they're the poorer for it. So how are they to recapture imaginative life without selling themselves to, what has enslaved them? There's a different problem for us in the West, which is how can we recapture a sense of a living world that we lost with a complex historical unfoldment through Catholicism, Protestantism, Scientism? How can we recapture a sense of a living world without naive neo-paganism and so forth and so on, fun as that may be? So I think that Buddhism in the modern world faces a fascinating problem. And frankly, so much of Eastern Buddhism is superstitious. There was an opening of the wonderful statue at Nagaloka, and a monk was giving a talk there. And, it was just a sort of form of magical Buddhism. You know, that if you chant certain things, you'll get certain benefits. You'll be saved from earthquakes and so on and so forth. It's just like Hinduism. A friend of mine standing next to me said, "What's the difference between this and Hinduism?" None. So much of modern Buddhism is just as superstitious. Which is okay, but we can't go there. And we don't want to go there. I remember a Tibetan teacher saying that he was appalled that many people came to him in the West having rejected Christianity, and they took to Tibetan Buddhism with a naive credulity that they scorned in Christianity. So how are we to reanimate the world? How are we to bring the imaginative life of the West, of our imaginative life, to bear on the practice of the Dhamma? Until that happens on a wide scale, Buddhism is not going to spread very far and wide. And I think we have to accept that we are very, very much in the early stages. We will not see the full unfolding of a Buddhist imagination in the modern West. But we are vital to it unfolding. And this is the theme that I want to pursue with you tomorrow. It's this that I'm writing about at the moment, and hoping to get the final threads together if I can get a week when I get back to Wales. It doesn't rain too heavily and my paper doesn't curl up in front of me. I shall finish this, and hopefully it'll be out before sometime in November. But I'm going to give you a bit of a preview and hopefully use you to test things out. And yes, there's some sort of experiments I want to do with you, because my theory is that actually we all of us have a much stronger imaginative connection with the Buddha than we recognize, because we try to put our imaginative connection into a form that doesn't work for all of us. For some it works. Again, I'd really stress, for some it works fine. But I doubt if we would be here, any of us would be here, if we did not have a living imaginative connection with the Buddha. So what I'm interested in is how we draw that out and embody it more in our collective life and in our personal practice, and how we make it into a practices that we begin to share and hand on. I've been exploring this actually for 10 or 12 years myself in my own meditation practice, and I will have some things to say about that. But what Bhante was saying to me, some of which he did say to me 10 or 12 years ago, which sparked me off then, but what he said quite unequivocally really strongly appealed to me, and I felt that here is the tail of the tiger. This is where the mystery leads. This is the way into the labyrinth. I think that we need to engage collectively in our order in a reimagining of the Buddha, as our ancestors in the Buddhist East have done again and again and again. But we need to sort of free ourselves from the straitjackets of their imaginations. Doesn't mean we don't need to be inspired by them, even inspired by some of the images, which may appeal very directly to some of us. But we need to free ourselves from it as a restriction or a straitjacket. Bhante was saying that he would like us to decisively separate ourselves from Tibetan Buddhism. It does not mean that we should not draw from Tibetan Buddhism. It does not mean that we should not gain inspiration from Tibetan Buddhism if that happens to appeal to us. But he feels that we should not identify ourselves with Tibetan Buddhism. I remember when I was first coming along, I really thought we were a sort of revised Tibetan Buddhist group. I thought we were an extension of Nyingma. And I remember having those discussions even after I was ordained. And maybe that was even quite common in those early days. But Bhante feels that, yes, it's not that anybody who's getting a lot from that sort of practice is doing anything wrong or that they should stop. But that as our principal imaginative framework, our principal location of our own authority should not be especially from Tibetan Buddhism. It's been encouraging for many years for people to draw from the iconography of Chinese Buddhism and other Buddhist traditions. But in a way, we can only draw a sort of distant inspiration from them. We have to be looking much more radically into our own imaginations for the Buddha. He's there. He must be there, otherwise we couldn't go for refuge to him. You can't go for refuge to the Buddha without having an imaginative connection with him. It's a sine qua non. So what does that look like? How do we bring it out into the light of day? How do we imagine it around us? Don't get me wrong, it's wonderful that Thousand-Armed Avalokiteshvara is there. But sometime, the next two or three generations, there will be something else there that emerges from the rich imaginative traditions of the West and that immediately goes deep into people's souls and pulls them towards it on a much larger, much wider scale. Some will be pulled by that. And good, wonderful. But if it's to happen on a wide scale, it's got to go much deeper into where we come from, who we are. In India, a different version of the same problem arises. How does the Buddha emerge from the Ambedkarite movement as a living presence? What's tending to happen is that Dr. Ambedkar is emerging as a living image. But Dr. Ambedkar always said, "My master, the Buddha." Dr. Ambedkar saw the Buddha as far greater than him. He saw himself as serving the Buddha. So the Buddha needs to emerge much more fully and richly. With Dr. Ambedkar as a very powerful imaginative intermediary to the Buddha. So, enough for tonight.
I guess it's to bring our pictures.
If you've got them, yeah. If you've got them, why not? Yeah. And yes, I will interrogate you all a bit on what is emerging for you. But first I want to go into quite a bit of theory, I'm afraid. Inevitably, that's my nature, I'm sorry. Some of you will be interested anyway. But we'll keep the imaginations boiling. We'll try to get into that. I think the theory is vitally important because I think we need a new theory of the practical side of Buddhist life, which I see, and Bhante seems to see, in a theory of imagination. Have I said everything I wanted to say tonight? Probably not. But I probably talked myself out. You've got some idea of the perspective. You've got some idea of right view. We talked about that. And of course, imagination is to do with the Kalyana. So that's Kalyanamitrita. So tomorrow the Kalyanamitrita, bit of it. And I think we're dealing with the very stuff of the evolution of Buddhism in the West, which is what really excites me. So, tomorrow morning, 7:30, here on the cushion, we'll do an imagination of the Buddha, but I won't give you much content. Bring your own picture. I'm not going to do very much, but I'd like you to take a little bit of inspiration from what I've said tonight. I don't want to fill the space that I hope I've created too much with my imagination. I'd like you to sit at the feet of the Buddha and see what arises for you. Don't be looking necessarily for an image in the literal sense of a visual image, because that's not the way it works, not for me anyway. I feel the Buddha. I sense the Buddha there. So I'd like you to sit at the feet of the Buddha. If you want to put your own sadhana in that space, I can't get in there and stop you. And I don't want to. But if you want to sort of follow the trajectory of the theme, leave a space and see what happens. See what comes into that space. And if I can stop talking at some point, we'll try and find out what's happening. Okay, bus.